content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Aniko Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Random House Book of Shakespeare Stories, from Kerrygold Butter Cookie Recipes, and This I Believe. Well, welcome back, everyone. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you, and today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, today we have a story from Shakespeare called King Henry V. It is how a boy king won a mighty battle. The scene: England and France in the 15th century. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon this charge cry, God for Harry, England, and St. George. All right, and this is King Henry, Act 3, Scene 1. Hardly anyone called the new king Henry. When they talked about him, they said Hal or Harry, or used one of his other nicknames. Everyone knew what a wild and rebellious teenager the young prince had been. He had spent more time with rascally old Sir John Falstaff, learning how to drink and gamble, than he had with his royal father. Now the reckless young Harry was king. But no one knew what sort of king he would be. Some thought he would be a disaster. Others said that only time would tell. But all were aware that the young king faced a difficult time as the new English monarch. England and France had been at war for 25 years, and though the two countries had come to a truce, it was an uneasy one. A weak English king who didn't have the support of his people might give the French the chance they wanted to carry out a successful invasion. One morning, not long after Henry's coronation, the nobles of the High Council were gathered together in the reception chamber of the King's Palace in London. Among them was the Duke of Exeter, the king's uncle. He knew that Henry was now about to face his most challenging test. How young and lonely he looks on the throne, Exeter thought. He has his mother's dark hair and soft eyes, but does he have any of his father's courage, I wonder? His question was soon answered. For just then the doors of the great chamber opened, and an ambassador from the Dauphin, the Crown Prince of France, entered. The ambassador was a perfumed man with a curled beard. The clothes he wore were as brightly colored as a peacock's feathers. Behind him, two guards carried a large wooden chest, which they set down on the floor. The ambassador gave an elaborate bow. "Your Highness," he said in a voice as smooth as honey, "my master, the Dauphin, sends greetings." "I want more than greetings," Henry replied coldly. "I ask King Charles to give me back the French lands that my father won from him. What is his answer?" The ambassador ran his fingers through the curls of his beard and smirked. "The king is busy with his important matters," he said. "His majesty thought that since the Dauphin is closer to you in age, it would be better for him to deal with your request." Henry felt a sting of anger at the ambassador's insolent tone, but he kept his voice calm. "And what is the Dauphin's message?" he asked. "The Dauphin thinks you are a little too young to bother yourself with affairs of state," said the ambassador, gesturing toward the wooden chest. "So he has sent a present that he thinks will be more suitable than the right to French dukedoms." The ambassador clicked his fingers, and the guards opened the lid of the chest. It was filled with tennis balls. One of them fell out and rolled to the foot of Henry's throne. The nobles glanced at each other anxiously. King Henry had been insulted and humiliated in front of all his courtiers. How would he respond? Henry leaned over and picked up the ball at his feet. He bounced it once and caught it in his right hand. "Tell the Dauphin that he has begun a game with me that he'll wish he had never started," he said. "His mockery will turn these tennis balls into cannonballs. The people of France may be laughing at the Dauphin's joke, but they'll weep before I'm finished." The ambassador's face went deathly pale. He bowed low and left the chamber. When the door closed behind him, the nobles began to talk among themselves. Most of them glanced admiringly at Henry, but the Earl of Cambridge scowled at the king. He raised his voice above the hubbub in the chamber and said, "Your Majesty spoke hastily. You should have sought the advice of older and wiser men before plunging our country into war. An insult to me is an insult to the English people," Henry snapped. "And besides, my Lord Cambridge, I don't listen to the advice of traitors." Cambridge started as though someone had jabbed him with a knife point, and his eyes bulged with fear. "You thought that because of my youth, I could easily be deceived," Henry went on. "But I have found you out. You betrayed our country for French gold and worked as a spy for King Charles. Guards, take him to the Tower." The nobles stared in astonishment at the disclosure of Cambridge's treachery and at seeing the determination of their young king. He was wiser and stronger-minded than any of them had realized. Men from all over the country answered the young king's call to war with France. Blacksmiths, wheelwrights, farm workers, weavers, and clerks all left their homes and marched along the roads that led to Southampton. The younger men thought that war would be a kind of holiday and were eager for fame and glory. Others, who had fought before and knew what battle was like, were grim-faced and silent. At Southampton, the men began their training. Hour after hour and day after day, they marched and drilled. At the archery butts, men with long bows practiced until their aim was true. Slowly, the raggle-taggle band of volunteers were transformed into an army. When all was ready, the English battle fleet set sail for the French port of Harfleur. It took all day for Henry's men to cross the channel and unload the ships. The men spent the night on the beach and were woken in the gray hours before dawn to sharpen their weapons and get their siege ladders and battering rams ready. On the skyline, the walls of Harfleur looked like an ominous cloud. When the sun rose, Henry rode out in front of his men on his dapple gray war horse, the early morning light glinting on his armor. "The English are a peaceful nation," he told the troops, "but when war comes, we can fight like tigers. Let the light of battle blaze in your eyes to burn the courage of your enemies. Let your cry be, 'God for Harry, England, and St. George.'" Cannons roared like a gigantic wave breaking on the shore as the English army charged. By nightfall, Harfleur had fallen. Henry was planning to advance to the port of Calais, which was already an English possession. The next morning, a messenger arrived from King Charles. "The king commands that you surrender to him and leave France while you still can," the messenger declared scornfully. "He is camped at Agincourt with an army of 50,000. If you do not agree to his terms, he will advance and crush you." "Your Majesty," the Duke of Exeter murmured, "we only have 4,000 men. If the French attack us here, all will be lost." "Then we must go to them, uncle," Henry said calmly. He turned to the messenger. "Tell King Charles that his army is in my way," he said. "I will march to Agincourt, and if he does not step aside, the earth will be red with French blood." And so the English advanced to Agincourt and set up camp facing the French on a plain between two woods. When the French saw the size of the English army, they whistled and jeered, beating their swords against their shields to make lots of noise. But Henry did not listen to their taunts and concentrated on positioning his forces. He discussed battle plans with his commanders late into the night. After they had left his tent, Henry tried to rest, but doubts and fears swirled in his mind, and he could not sleep. Hoping to calm himself, he put on a hooded cloak and went walking through the camp. His soldiers lay asleep, huddled around fires. The air was filled with the sounds of snores and voices, shouting out in terror through nightmares. Across the plain glimmered the fires of the French camp, as numberless as the stars on a winter's night. Henry was so deep in thought that he didn't notice a sentry on guard beside one campfire until he almost walked onto the point of the man's spear. "Who goes there?" barked the sentry. "A friend," Henry replied. "Who is your commander?" "The Duke of Exeter." The guard lowered his spear and pulled a face. "A fine soldier," he grunted. "If he were leading the army instead of the king, we wouldn't be in this mess. I bet young Harry wishes he was back in London, tucked up safe in bed." "The king wishes himself nowhere but here," said Henry. The guard turned his head and spit into the fire. Light from the flames played across his broken nose and the long scar on his left cheek. "Kings," he growled. "They do the arguing, but it's the likes of you and me who do the fighting and the dying. Tomorrow the king will fight in the front line alongside his men. You will see," said Henry. "I'll bet a week's wages that he'll be at the back with a fast horse ready for his escape," the guard said bitterly. "Very well," said Henry. "If we both survive, find me when the battle's over, and we'll see who is right. What's your name?" "Michael Williams," said the guard. "What's yours?" "Harry Le Roy," Henry said with a smile. Then he passed on and disappeared into the darkness. In the early hours of the morning, a thunderstorm broke. Rain fell mercilessly, drenching English and French alike, and turning the plain into a sea of mud. The rain stopped just before dawn, but the sky was still filled, with heavy black clouds. The first line of the French army took the field, led by knights on horseback. The plumes on their helmets fluttered brightly against the dark sky, and their armor shone like silver. Behind them ran infantrymen in chain mail coats, carrying blue shields painted with golden fleur-de-lis. Henry ordered his archers to stand ready and wait for his signal. The French knights broke into a gallop. The hooves of the horses shook the ground and spattered their riders with mud. The knights lowered their lances and screamed out a battle cry. But halfway to the English line, the French horses ran into boggy ground, and the charge faltered. The knights pulled at their reins in panic, turning their horses to try and find firmer footing. The infantrymen caught up, and all was a surging chaos of whinnying horses and cursing men. Henry drew his sword and swept it high above his head. "Fire!" he bellowed. At his command, 1,000 arrows left 1,000 long boughs and made a sound like a wind sighing through the boughs of a forest. A deadly hail struck the French, piercing armor and flesh and bone. Knights fell from their saddles and startled horses bolted, trampling anyone who stood in their way. Volley after volley of arrows whistled down until the only movement on the battlefield came from the wounded as they attempted to crawl back to safety. A second line of French troops charged. Once more the English archers stopped them. The French tried to retreat but ran into their own third line as it came up behind them. It was then that Henry led his men in a charge. The two armies met with a clash like a clap of thunder. The fighting lasted for 2 hours. The French soldiers, dismayed and confused, found that their commanders had been killed and there was no one to give them orders. They fought bravely, but the fury of the English attack proved too much for them, and at last they broke ranks and fled. 7,000 Frenchmen died at Agincourt, including many great noblemen. The English lost only 100 men. That night at sunset, a French messenger rode into the English camp, carrying a white flag of truce. It was the same man who had come to Harfleur, but this time he was not haughty. His armor was dented, and there was dirt and blood on his face. "King Charles begs for peace," he said humbly. "He will return all the land that you claim, and he asks you to accept the hand of his daughter, Princess Catherine. Then your two families may be united in peace forever." "Tell the king that I accept," said Henry. "We will meet and draw up a peace treaty." That night, there were celebrations in the English camp. Just before midnight, Henry slipped away from his commanders and went in search of Michael Williams. He found him at the same guard point as on the previous night. When Williams saw Henry, he dropped to one knee. "Your Majesty," he mumbled, "I did not know who you were last night, but I recognized you today when you led the charge." "So," said Henry, smiling, "I won the wager." "I was a fool to speak the way I did last night," said the sentry apologetically. Henry put his hand on the man's shoulder and took a bag of gold coins from his belt. He handed it to the astonished guard. "Here," Henry said, "you spoke your mind last night. I hope that honest men will always speak to me as openly as you did." So King Henry V won a famous victory. And more importantly, he won the hearts of all his subjects. Now they respected him as a ruler, but they also loved him because he understood the lives of ordinary people and was always ready to listen to them. When he met Catherine, the French princess, they fell in love at once, even though she could speak no English, and his clumsy French made her laugh. With their marriage, the bitter war with France was ended in feasting and friendship. This Star of England, fortune made his sword, by which the world's best garden be achieved. And that was the story of King Henry V. And now we're going to have a short essay from the book This I Believe. This I Believe essay was written by Miles Goodwin. It is entitled The Connection Between Strangers. On June 23, 1970, I had just been mustered out of the Army after completing my one-year tour of duty in Vietnam. I was 23 years old, Army veteran, on a plane from Oakland, California, returning home to Dallas, Texas. I had been warned about the hostility many of our fellow countrymen felt toward returning Nam vets at that time. There were no hometown parades for us when we came home from that unpopular war. Like tens of thousands of others, I was just trying to get home without incident. I sat in uniform in a window seat, chain smoking and avoiding eye contact with my fellow passengers. No one was sitting in the seat next to me, which added to my isolation. A young girl, not more than 10 years old, suddenly appeared in the aisle. She smiled and, without a word, timidly handed me a magazine. I accepted her offering, her quiet, "Welcome home." All I could say was, "Thank you." I do not know where she sat down or who she was with, because right after accepting the magazine from her, I turned to the window and wept. Her small gesture of compassion was the first I had experienced in a long time. I believe in the connection between strangers when they reach out to one another. That young girl undoubtedly has no memory of what happened years ago. I like to think of her as having grown up, continuing to touch others, and teaching her children to do the same. I know she might have been told to give me the gift by her mother. Her father might still have been in Vietnam at that point, or maybe he had not survived the war. It doesn't matter why she gave me the magazine. The important thing is, she did. Since then, I have followed her example and tried, in different ways for different people, to do the same for them. Like me, on that long-ago plane ride, they will never know why a stranger took the time to extend a hand. But I know that my attempts, since then, are all because of that little girl. Her offer of a magazine to a tired, scared, and lonely soldier has echoed throughout my life. I have to believe that my small gestures have the same effect on others. And to that little girl, now a woman, I would like to take this opportunity to say again, thank you. Miles Goodwin is a real estate attorney in Milwaukee. During the Vietnam War, he was a clerk for the U.S. Army headquarters outside Saigon. Goodwin says it took about 10 years after his discharge before he told people about his service there. He enjoys family, investing, and riding motorcycles. All right, and we are going to end with an absolutely scrumptious cookie recipe, something you might want to take to school with you. And it comes from the Kerrygold Pure Irish Butter Company, and it is called Slice and Bake Butter Cookies. These basic cookies are a perfect dessert that can be prepared ahead of time and kept on hand for surprise guests. They can be frozen, thawed, and baked, and still retain the moist, delicate mouthfeel that only grass-fed cow's milk Irish butter can bring. Simple and delicious, they're a must-have in your culinary repertoire. Ingredients: 2 cups unbleached all-purpose flour, 1/2 teaspoon baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 2 sticks salted Kerrygold Pure Irish Butter at room temperature, 2/3 cup granulated sugar, 2 large egg yolks, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1 large egg white, 1/3 cup granulated sugar or coarse sugar crystals for rolling the cookie log, pecan halves or walnut halves, which are optional. Directions: sift flour, baking powder, and salt into medium bowl and set aside. In large bowl, beat Kerrygold pure Irish butter and sugar until lightened in color and fluffy, using an electric mixer on medium speed about 2 minutes. Mix in egg yolks and vanilla. Add flour mixture, mixing on low speed just until flour is incorporated and soft. Smooth dough forms. Divide dough into 2 pieces. Form each into a log about 7.5 inches long and 1.5 inches in diameter. Wrap each in plastic wrap. Refrigerate about 1 hour until cold and firm or overnight. Or freeze, wrapped securely, for up to 1 month. Defrost in the refrigerator before slicing and baking. Position rack in middle of oven, heat oven to 325 degrees Fahrenheit. Line 2 baking sheets with parchment paper. In small bowl, use fork to beat egg white until foamy, about 30 seconds. Use pastry brush to brush each log with egg white. Sprinkle the 1/3 cup sugar on strip of wax paper, then roll each log back and forth in sugar to coat lightly. Use large sharp knife to cut each log into 1/4 inch thick rounds. Place 1 inch apart on prepared baking sheets. Press nut half into each cookie before baking if desired. Bake 1 sheet at a time until cookie edges and bottoms are light brown, about 18 minutes. Cool 5 minutes on baking sheet, then transfer to wire rack to cool completely. Store in tightly covered container at room temperature up to 3 days, and it makes 60 cookies. Well, I sure hope you will enjoy those yummy sounding cookies. Well, we are out of time right now for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Aniko Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.